Hi, it's Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind, the Democratic Party shifts left. Bernie Sanders made it official this week. He's running for president in 2020. But unlike his candidacy in 2016, this time he'll be surrounded by a pack of presidential hopefuls advocating for many of the same liberal policies, a sign that the party as a whole is a more progressive one than just a few years ago. But how much support is there among rank-and-file voters for these positions, and can they win elections? I asked NPR's Ron Elving for some answers. Ron Elving, great to see you as always.
Such a pleasure to be here.
So Bernie Sanders just announced he's back in for another chance to be president of the United States. He talks about all the things that he pushed for in the last election, which now most of the Democratic candidates are pushing for themselves. So there are a lot of people wondering whether the Democratic candidates and the party is being pushed too far to the left and is falling into that Democratic socialist category.
Many people are wondering that because it's an excellent question, because so many of the candidates are speaking the language of Bernie Sanders 2016, which was democratic socialism. He always called himself that. In fact, he was not a member of the Democratic Party except as a candidate for its presidential nomination. And as soon as that was all over, he went right back to being an independent. So he represents Vermont as an independent. And so he is probably a democratic socialist, meaning not so much big D democratic, but small D democratic in the sense that he believes in electing our officials. So those ideas have really taken over in the Democratic Party.
And spell out the ideas we're talking about.
The two biggest issues probably are Medicare for All, which is a single-payer approach to the healthcare system, eventually getting rid of private health insurance and having the sort of system they have in Canada and in Europe, where the government essentially organizes the healthcare system. And people pay taxes, but they don't pay for the health care the way we do now, and everything is quite controlled. That has a lot of appeal if you need health care and don't have a lot of money. And increasingly, Americans don't have enough money to afford the health care that they need. So this does appear to be the future. The question is timetable.
He is also talking about raising taxes on the wealthy.
Absolutely. And all the Democratic candidates really in varying degrees are doing that. Elizabeth Warren, for example, has proposed a wealth tax on the highest incomes, people making $1 million a year. That's, I suppose, the new definition of millionaire. Once it meant having a million, now it means making one every year. So she's proposed that. And all the Democratic candidates are talking about supporting some big programs. In addition to the health care, Bernie Sanders has proposed that public universities and colleges be free, that they have tuition-free admission to, say, the residents of that state or people from other states that have reciprocal agreements. So there would still be private universities. They would presumably still cost an arm and a leg, but that the overall resources of the community through general revenues would support higher education.
Isn't he also raising the idea of child care for everybody?
Yes, because there is no greater conflict for people who are entering the workforce, and we're primarily talking here about women, but men as well, than the challenge of how do you deal with your children, particularly the youngest children, before their school age, but even school-age children, before school, after school. How do you deal with their needs when you need to go make a living and support those children? So that is something that people have wrestled with all over the world, and many traditional societies have essentially resolved it by letting women do all of it and making the men responsible solely for the income. That's in the past. That's in the rearview mirror for this country and for European societies. People have moved on to a more general definition of the sharing of responsibilities. And ultimately, that means that people who do not make enough money to hire somebody to take care of their children, a nanny or what have you, need to have some kind of programs that can take care of their kids. And ultimately, while churches and synagogues and other places have tried to step into this gap, ultimately that means the government.
So are you at all surprised that all of these candidates on the Democratic side have more or less adopted these ideas, and they're now sort of, that's what's front and center?
Not too surprised. I do think there's going to be significant argument over the term socialism. I think, for example, Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, has said very distinctly, I do not consider myself a socialist. Elizabeth Warren likes to call herself a proud capitalist, even though a lot of people on Wall Street don't like Elizabeth Warren. She was a Harvard professor in business, and she talked about finance, and she actually is not a socialist, and certainly Joe Biden doesn't consider himself a socialist. But all of these people have considered themselves more or less, in one degree or another, liberals. And they do believe in a government role. And they do believe that the government has moved too far in favor of the wealthy and too far in favor of a kind of almost 19th century Gilded Age laissez-faire approach to the wealthy.
So, Ron, what do you see behind this swing on the part of the Democrats to follow what was considered way out there when Bernie Sanders first ran?
To some degree, it's Donald Trump. To some degree, it's the effect of having a president who is, in the minds of many Democrats, most Democrats, so offensive to their ideas of whether it's the New Deal or the Great Society or whatever makes them more attracted to the Democratic side of things than the Republican side of things. And we're talking here about people who make up their minds on the basis of ideas and issues and ideology, as opposed to people who simply inherit a party loyalty from parents and grandparents. That's kind of gone out of style. For a long time, people were just automatically one or the other because grandpappy was and great-great-grandpappy was. And there was also regional allegiance, so that if you were from the Deep South, you were automatically a Democrat and Republicans just weren't on the map. Now that's all kind of gone. And New England, the old home of the Republican Party or the upper Midwest, those areas are quite heavily contested now. And usually they're Democratic. They're blue. Blue states, nothing's bluer than New England at this point. And the Deep South, that was once so Democratic. They talked about voting for a yellow dog as long as he was a Democrat. Remember that term, yellow dog Democrat? Those areas have become the strongest part of the Republican base in the country. So all that regional sort of alignment and allegiance is gone, and people are making up their minds more on the candidates and what the candidates are espousing. And in that environment, we're seeing more and more Democrats see their bread is buttered on the side of much more egalitarian economics.
And what about wealthy Democratic voters? Are they in favor of higher taxes on the wealthy?
Well, that's a mix. You've got Howard Schultz, for example, who's talking about running for president as an independent, but calls himself a lifelong Democrat, and I can't say he isn't. And certainly there are a lot of people like Howard Schultz who have been very successful business people, but who didn't necessarily come from inherited money. Schultz came from a middle-class background. Those people have made a great deal of money and oftentimes want to defend it and will say, I don't really think that this is the answer. Michael Bloomberg, another person who's back and forth in and out of Democratic identification, I believe he's saying he's a Democrat right now. But the very wealthy are – they take a very, generally speaking, a dim view of extreme taxation of the wealthy. But let's remember World War II era, 90% was the last dollar percentage that people paid. The very wealthiest people in the country were paying 90% on their last dollar of income. That was still in the 70s.
Yep.
In Ronald Reagan's first year as president, that's what he wanted to go after. That was what he said converted him from a Democrat to a Republican, was the notion that somebody should pay most of their income to the federal government, 70% of their income, even at the last dollar, even with all of their tax shelters. The idea that somebody would give most of their money to the government was offensive to him and to a lot of other people with money. Now, nowadays, you've got a Democratic or a liberal kind of influence among many people with great amounts of money, multimillionaires, even billionaires. But generally speaking, their attraction to the Democratic Party is not based on a super tax rate for the wealthy.
Ron, give me a little lesson on what happens in Sweden and Finland and Switzerland, for example. What percentage do the wealthy pay in order to have all the social benefits that they do?
I couldn't give you the exact rate, but it is a long-established principle in Scandinavian countries, which is why Bernie Sanders in his announcement speech referenced them in particular, our friends in Scandinavia, as he put it. Those countries take the view that the wealthiest people can pay far more in percentage terms, extreme progressive rates, so that, yes, you would pay 50% and more of your income to the government, and that that then would carry along the community in which you are still, of course, a privileged member. You have better places to live, and you have more expensive things, and you have more access to some things that the wealthy can have, certainly in terms of travel and getting out of the country and what have you. But when it comes to the basics of education and when it comes to healthcare, that it is a community that shares and shares alike. There are certainly opportunities for people to get out of the country and get healthcare somewhere else. But the general presumption is that a basic level of education and healthcare is guaranteed to all, and that people pay into that based on their ability to pay.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more from Ron Elving.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Ron Elving. He's senior editor and correspondent for NPR. Let's talk about climate change and how appealing that whole issue is to the broad swath of Democratic voters.
Among Democratic voters, climate change is not really a controversy. This is something where the party has resolved itself, I think, even more than on the question of, say, Medicare for All, as that's the shorthand for the healthcare system, single payer, or for that matter, free tuition in colleges. I think there's a lot more division about some of those questions than there is about climate change. There just is not a presence in the Democratic Party anymore to contest this issue. Partly this reflects the loss of Democratic office holders in the oil patch states. And when you look at an Oklahoma or some of the other states, Wyoming, where energy is paramount as part of their economy, in those states, it's hard for people to quite accept what their minds may be telling them the evidence shows about climate change, because it is so severe in terms of its potential effects for their basic industry. Those are not Democratic states anymore.
So you've got President Trump and Republicans who do not accept the reality of climate change, ready to pounce, ready to call Democrats who support measures to go after climate change. Even the idea of reducing emissions from automobiles, I mean, the president just says is ridiculous.
There is a commission that's been appointed by the president to re-examine the question of climate change as though it were in question. I won't attempt to make an analogy to some of the other things you might ask about, you know, the flatness of the earth or something of that nature. But there is a commission that the president has put together. And he has included on that a particular individual who's well known for his skepticism, let's put it that way, if not outright denial of the evidence on climate change. Without impugning the motives of the people who take that point of view, it is clearly an opportunity for the Republican Party to go after a certain kind of voter who may have some reliance on either the energy industry, which is an enormous industry, or the agricultural industry, because the Green New Deal, as it's sometimes called and is, has been promoted by some of the new Democrats, not necessarily presidential candidates, but people such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's certainly getting an awful lot of attention for a freshman member of the House. That would involve some major move away from internal combustion engines, away from some forms of agriculture, and ultimately even away from eating meat and so forth, you know, moving towards not just a Green New Deal in terms of energy, but a much healthier lifestyle for the country as a whole. Some people are ready for that. Obviously, many people are not ready for that. And so Republicans and others are already parodying this as though that were the inevitable result of taking climate change seriously. There's obviously a lot of middle ground between that sort of plan, extreme plan, and other people's definition of a Green New Deal.
Amy Klobuchar, whom you mentioned earlier, is certainly one of those people who is standing up strongly about climate change and what needs to be done. I would think that the president, as well as many of the other Democratic candidates, the president is going to go after big time on the climate change issue.
Yes, and there is going to be, I think, a clear distinction made in the 2020 race. And to some degree, we saw this in 16, but I think it will be much more stark, as you suggest, in 2020, between the president valuing and speaking to people who value things from the past, whether that be their ideas of who is an American or how people should come into the country, or whether it's traditional arrangements between families, within families, between men and women, whether it's traditional ways in which businesses are run. All of those ideas that have been prevalent, say, 20th century and before. Whereas the Democratic Party is going to find itself increasingly identified with things that have changed. Climate change, the unmanageability of the education and medical costs that young people are facing. So there's a reason that in some primaries in 2016, Bernie Sanders, with his ideas, was winning 7-1 over Hillary Clinton among voters under 30, among Democratic voters under 30. And there's a reason why you see such a youth movement. We have the widest space between the oldest Democratic candidate and the youngest Democratic candidate. What we've ever seen, it's a 40-year span. It's a lifetime span from people in their later 30s to people in their later 70s, both running or all running for the same office at the same time. And the interesting thing, though, is that Bernie Sanders is the oldest of the group at 77, and he's the guy who a lot of young people identify with. And of those 225,000 people who have already sent him money for 2020, a big percentage of that is people under 30. They believe in 77-year-old Bernie Sanders and his commitment to those things.
What about Beto O'Rourke?
Well, O'Rourke hasn't decided and has not really tipped his hand yet. Joe Biden hasn't either. And some people actually wonder if maybe Joe Biden might not run. He's currently leading. He's got at least a 10-point lead on Bernie in the Monmouth University poll and other polls. So Biden has got some time. He can wait. He can bide his time, if you will, and he can decide when to run when he thinks that time is right and people have gotten a little tired of all the new faces, which is probably going to happen in a few months because there are so many new faces to get through. But eventually people will look around and say, who else you got? And Joe may decide to wait until then. On the other hand, he could jump in tomorrow if he thinks that the time is right. I still think he's going to run. Beto O'Rourke, I'm not so sure.
You don't think he's going
to run? Oh, I do think he's going to run.
You do?
I think Biden definitely is going to run. I would be very surprised if he didn't. And, of course, I don't know anything in particular about his own personal situation. And people have health issues. People have family issues. But in his particular case, he seems to be the healthiest he's been in quite a while. And I shouldn't make it sound as though he's gotten healthy. He seems to be quite vibrant as ever. Let's put it that way. But Beto O'Rourke is another question. I think he may be seeing this field as a little too crowded. He may be thinking himself a little bit further behind some of the other young candidates and some of the other candidates with the kind of ideas we've been talking about. And fundraising, while he was a phenomenal fundraiser running against Ted Cruz in Texas, that may be a little more of a challenge when he's running against Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar and Bernie Sanders, because some of those same dollars are not going to come his way.
What about former New York Mayor Bloomberg? Do you think he's going to get into the race?
If he does get in the race, I believe he will get in as a Democrat. He has been critical of Howard Schultz, saying if you run as an independent, you split the not-for-Trump vote. And maybe we should just call it the anti-Trump vote because it is pretty personal for a lot of folks. If there is a certain number out there that will not vote for Trump and the polls indicate that that is the case, then the Democratic Party needs to get as big a share of that number as they possibly can in order to win. And a big candidate with a lot of money, unlimited resources, such as a Bloomberg or a Schultz, that person could take 5-6. The polls show Schultz getting something like 7 or 8% of the vote. That's, of course, a very early indication, and he hasn't had what you'd call a terribly charming or attractive rollout. But if he were to get 7 or 8% of the vote, and if it came 2-1 from Democrats, as the polls indicate, and he is, after all, a lifelong Democrat, that could re-elect Donald Trump.
We have talked about how the Democrats have really moved to the left, adopting many of the policies that Bernie Sanders campaigned on. How vulnerable do you think those Democrats would be, any of them, up against Donald Trump? We saw how he sliced through even people at the top of the Republican Party. He, a man who had never run for office, who had no legislative background, he did it. And one wonders, considering these far-left ideas like higher taxes on the wealthy and free college education, what do you think he would do, and what can Democrats do to inoculate themselves?
There probably is nothing that can be done to inoculate yourself against the attacks of Donald Trump. He is a highly effective attacker, and he was very good at slicing through, as you say, that big field of Republican candidates, because all those people had legislative records, and he could go after them on that, or he could go after them for things they had said or things they had represented, or he could go after Jeb Bush for everything that people got tired of the Bush family for. So he was running against a lot of people who provided big targets, and here's the other thing. Those candidates were afraid to go punch back at Donald Trump, because they all assumed at some point he would fall to the wayside, that he would drop out, and they wanted his supporters. And now, today, you see a Congress with a lot of Republicans who also, whatever trouble they may have with Donald Trump, and what many senators are quite unkind to him in private, but they don't want to say it in public because they need his supporters. And if they're seen as anti-Trump in the Republican Party, they're dead in the next primary. Now, Democrats aren't going to have that same problem. They're going to be vulnerable. A lot of independent voters are going to have a hard time biting down on some of these things the Democrats say they're going to do. And they'll have to decide which of the aspirations speaks to me. Do I want the kind of country that Donald Trump wants, or do I want the kind of country that these Democrats are describing, knowing that neither is going to happen overnight, neither Donald Trump rolling everything back to 1958, nor Bernie Sanders bringing everything into the 21st century. Neither of those things is going to happen overnight. So the question becomes, what are we aspiring to? What are we aiming for? What do we want America to be next? And they'll have to make that decision.
Well, but this time, Donald Trump's own performance is on the line. And that would be something that any Democrat could and would go after. How strong do you think his base is? How big is it? Is it enough to get him reelected, considering the points that any Democratic nominee will make about his performance?
We don't know yet at this point whether or not the Mueller report, the Robert Mueller investigation of the Russian collusion,
may come out this week.
It may be coming very soon. We don't know what effect that will have. We don't know what effect the investigations that are now underway in the House of Representatives will have. There are many. There are more than a dozen committees and subcommittees that want to look at Donald Trump out of the House and at his administration, not just at him personally. But that's going to be a drumbeat for pretty much the next 20 months, and we're going to learn a lot. And those things will color people's impression of Donald Trump, apart and aside from everything that's happened up to now. But what's happened up to now has kept him in a very narrow range, where he goes from the high 30s to the mid 40s in terms of his approval number. Historically, that would not be enough to get him reelected, unless his base could add to it. And I would say his base ranges from maybe 25% super hard base up to about 40%, the people who say they approve of him at this point. And they need to add to that another 5 to 10 points from people who may not approve but will be more disapproving, as you suggest, of the Democrats, and particularly if they are seen as extreme in 2020. And they would win out in a contest between undesirables. And even in 2016, you know, those were the two least popular, least approved candidates we've had for president from the two major parties since polling began. And we'll see that again in 2020. I suspect that the Democrat will be beaten in bloodied and battered by the time we get to November 2020. And obviously, Donald Trump already is those things and is probably going to take some pretty severe blows in the next 20 months.
But right now, there's lots of enthusiasm for these Democratic candidates.
Yes, among Democrats. And I think in some cases, some of these people seem to have some crossover appeal, either personal appeal or because of the nature of their ideas. For example, Bernie Sanders, while he might alienate some people, also speaks to a lot of the folks who voted for Donald Trump, who were not happy with Hillary Clinton, who saw her as a figure of the past and a moderate and sort of lukewarmish and not really their friend. Many of those voters, I'm thinking here in particular about white working class males of a certain age in certain states, who wound up voting for Donald Trump after voting once or twice for Barack Obama, those people could come back. I don't know if Bernie Sanders is the magic person to make that happen, but someone within this matrix of Democratic ideas and candidacies that we've been discussing, someone in that group could emerge. And we'll have to wait and see what the primaries have to tell us, and we'll have to see what the debates have to tell us, and who seems to be that person who could put it all together the way Barack Obama did or Bill Clinton did in his day.
It's going to be fascinating to see whether the country as a whole could get behind one of these already announced or those to come candidates and really back them.
Yes, and that's what it takes. I mean, you have to catch fire at some point. You can't just limp to the finish line and have a few more delegates than somebody else. It's possible we'll have a crazy convention wherever they wind up going. They're talking about Houston, Miami, and Milwaukee. Milwaukee would be interesting. They're talking about those cities. Wherever we wind up, the Democrats could wind up with a really wild convention where no one's close to having half the delegates. That's possible. That could happen with a big field with a lot of appeal, a lot of different candidates with appeal. Maybe nobody has 50% of the delegates when we get there, and they've already cut down on their number of superdelegates so that they're not going to have the same sort of central party control they've had in the past. So it could be quite a show.
Quite a show. Ron Helving, as always, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Bent Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced this week by Rebecca Kaufman and Sandra Baker. Our engineer for today's show is Cliff Gallagher and Josephine Ioni. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next Tuesday. I'm Diane Rehm.